Welcome back to another episode of White Coats Real Talk. I'm Akshara Anand.
And I'm your co-host, Atharva Anand.
White Coats Real Talk is a podcast where we connect with incredible physicians to break down complex medical topics into real-life conversations. We want to make healthcare relatable and engaging for teens and young adults, while also spotlighting the passion and humanity behind the white coat. Now imagine this. You're operating inside someone's chest, just inches from their heart, carefully navigating nerves and arteries to remove a tumor and save their breath. That's just another day in the OR for today's guest, who works at the intersection of precision, pressure, and hope.
Dr. Douglas Liu is a clinical associate professor of cardiothoracic surgery at Stanford University School of Medicine, specializing in cardiothoracic surgery, where he treats everything from lung cancer to chest trauma using some of the most advanced surgical tools in the world. Whether it's robotic-assisted surgery, removing half a lung, or treating young non-smokers with stage four cancer, he's seen it all. And today, he's here to help us understand what it really means to breathe, to heal, and to fight for life from the inside out. Please welcome to the podcast, Dr. Douglas Liu. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much, Atharva and Akshara, for having me here today. It was wonderful to learn about this project that the two of you are doing, and it's so impressive. So congratulations to the two of you, and I'm happy to be a part of this.
Thank you so much. And we're really excited to talk about these topics with you today. And so let's just begin. And most people have heard of open heart surgery. But fewer realize that the chest holds more than just the heart. And as a cardiothoracic surgeon, you operate on the lungs, the esophagus, the diaphragm, and more. Can you help us understand the difference between cardiac and cardiac thoracic surgery and what makes
Absolutely.
your job so uniquely challenging?
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. That's a great first question because, there can be a lot of confusion about our surgical subspecialty, which is formally considered cardiothoracic surgery. But if we sort of go back to the history of chest surgery, back when chest surgery first started, it was sort of one individual who operated in the chest, sort of analogous to the way that, many, many years ago, there was sort of one specialty of general surgery that sort of did it all, right? As we gain more medical knowledge and sophistication, it's a natural thing for a broader specialty to then subspecialize because there's just so much information and knowledge and technical skills needed for each of these subspecialties, right? So this day and age, it's unusual now to, for example, find a surgeon who, on one day of the week will do a big aorta surgery, and then on the next day of the week would do a big pancreas surgery, right? It just doesn't make sense anymore because things are so subspecialized. So similar things have happened in my specialty, which was formerly called thoracic surgery, and then when things became more specialized and heart surgery sort of became its own thing and thoracic cancer surgery kind of became its own specialty, then naturally things became more subspecialized. So this day and age, at most major institutions, you have your cardiac surgeons, okay, and those are the individuals who do heart surgery, heart valve surgery, coronary bypass surgery, aortic surgery, things of that nature. Then you have what we now call thoracic surgeons or general thoracic surgeons, who are the individuals who do chest surgery for pretty much everything else in the chest outside of the heart and the great vessel. So we're talking about lung, esophagus, diaphragm, the rib cage. There's nerves in the chest that sometimes need things done to them, the airway, you name it. So if it's in the chest, then generally that's part of what a general thoracic surgeon does. The third sort of subspecialty within cardiothoracic surgery would be congenital heart surgery, which is basically used to be considered baby heart surgery, like pediatric heart surgery. But what happens over time, of course, is we get better at taking care of these babies with these congenital heart conditions, and many of these live into adulthood. And yet these folks who are now adults often get their surgery with the same sort of congenital heart surgery team. So it's referred to less often now as pediatric heart surgery and now more so congenital heart surgery. So those are kind of the three major kind of subdivisions within the specialty of cardiothoracic surgery. And that's kind of the way that we sort of think about it now. But I certainly appreciate that the semantics and the naming of things can kind of cause some confusion, even amongst doctors. This day and age, even some doctors have some confusion. Outside of a surgical specialty, for example, they have a hard time understanding, well, what's a cardiac surgeon versus a thoracic surgeon versus a cardiothoracic surgeon? Yeah, I understand it can be a little confusing.
Yeah, for sure. So many different specialties, and even in surgery, cardiac surgery. And so you specialized in cardiothoracic surgery when you could have chosen many other surgery types or any other specialties. Why did you choose this specialty? And did you have something in mind before you switched, though?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I knew I wanted to be a chest surgeon probably at the midpoint of my surgical training career. So just sort of take a step back. The pathway to becoming a surgeon kind of goes like this. So you go to your undergraduate studies, right? And then from there you go to medical school. And following medical school, then you apply for what's called a residency, right? A residency is basically where medical graduates, so these are people who have a medical degree, they've earned their medical degree, they go out and they do basically you might consider on the job training. Okay, so you are doctors, you are in the hospital, you are in clinics, you are taking care of patients, but you are sort of learning on the job kind of thing, right? So it was during that period when I was a general surgery resident that I decided that I was very interested in chest surgery and eventually decided to pursue that. One of the things that really led me to that decision was I knew early on that I wanted to treat oncology, that the type of surgery I wanted to do was cancer surgery. And it just, took some time to figure out what part of the body where I was most interested in. And I felt like that's where I wanted to treat the cancer. And it ended up being chest surgery. But one of the reasons why it was so appealing is because I and a lot of other general thoracic surgeons feel that it remains one of the few pretty diverse fields within the surgical subspecialties. From the standpoint of, we've talked a lot about chest surgery already, but it's important to recognize that there are some structures that, although they're primarily in the chest, they may run through the neck and then extend into the abdomen, right? So the esophagus is one example, right? And so that means that a thoracic surgeon who has expertise in esophagus issues is fluent and an expert in not only chest surgery, but also maybe some neck surgery where the esophagus runs in the neck, and also some abdominal surgery where it goes below diaphragm and there's issues with the esophagus down below the diaphragm. So there's some diversity and some breadth of being able to operate in the chest, in the belly, in the neck, in different parts of the body. It's also diverse from the standpoint that, a lot of it is lung surgery, but there are other structures in the chest that are not lungs, right? So we do esophagus surgery, which is the GI tract. Sometimes we operate on issues with the bones, sometimes which are the ribs. Sometimes we operate on issues with muscles, which is the diaphragm muscle, right? And even nerves, like I mentioned. So there's a lot of diversity in, as to what a general thoracic surgeon can and does do in their practice, and that was very appealing as well. But the main reason was because I knew I wanted to be a surgical oncologist, and this is what interested me the most.
It is very clear to see that being a cardiothoracic surgeon isn't just a career, it's a marathon with all the training and basically everything that you do and I like on a daily basis. Earlier you did mention being an oncology surgeon. And so lung cancer is one of the leading cause of cancer death worldwide for both women and men. In fact, it kills more people each year than breast, colon, and prostate cancer combined. And obviously we've made huge advances in treating many cancers. Yeah, lung cancer still kills more people than breast and all of them combined. Why is that? What makes lung cancer so difficult to beat?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the most common cancer, one amongst the most common cancers that a human being can get. And so that's one of the factors being that it just happens to be one of the more common cancers. For a long time, much like many other cancers, these are situations where if we wait for symptoms, then almost always the disease or the cancer has gone beyond an early stage situation and gone into something more locally advanced or has spread to other parts of the body, meaning metastatic, right? And so you can imagine those are much more difficult situations to cure. In some of the other more common cancers, such as breast, prostate, and colon, a lot of progress has been made on improving their survival and cure rates for those cancers. And in large part, that was related to screening, right? So if you're a woman of the appropriate age, you every single year can and should go and get your screening mammogram, right? According to what your doctor recommends. Similar with colon cancer, right? Depending on your personal situation, you should get colon cancer screening once every few years, depending again on your specific situation related to your genetics and maybe family history of colon cancer. But the point is, these screening tests allowed us to find these other more common cancers much sooner than when waiting until patients develop symptoms, right? So I think that was a big part of that. Lung cancer screening is now something that is done, approved. This is an insurance-covered test that any American who has insurance coverage, who meets the eligibility criteria, can go on and talk to their doctor and then go and get a screening CT scan to help to as a means to try and identify lung cancers, where they're much smaller, earlier stage, and easier to cure. And we're seeing some effects of that. Lung cancer screening has been an approved test for about a decade or so. There's still a lot of work to do to kind of spread that knowledge to the general population and explain to people what is lung cancer screening, what is the test that's done, and how does that help? What are the pros and cons of having a screening CT scan? So a lot of more outreach and education needs to be done for that for the general public, but we're making some progress. And the progress that we're making, we're seeing that the number of early stage lung cancer we're finding is increasing. And I think that's going to be a big part of this.
Amazing. So one of the books that we read was When Breath Becomes Air by Dr. Paul Kalanithi, if you didn't know, a Stanford neurosurgeon who like reflected on life, purpose, and really facing mortality after being diagnosed with stage four lung cancer at just 37. And we saw that his story is very powerful. And as someone who treats lung cancer patients, how do you really approach cases like his where the cause is like really invisible and the patient is really young and healthy and full of potential but dies at a young age?
I have to say, Atharva, those are amongst the most challenging situations to be in medicine, whether it's related to oncology or not. Any kind of unexpected, serious medical problem, particularly at a young age, can be very challenging. We treat any patient with whatever their medical condition is with the same compassion and attention and empathy that we can do. It is true that when we're at a stage four cancer of any variety, the tools and different treatments we have to offer are different than somebody who, for example, has an early stage cancer. But the approach in terms of discussing the issue, laying out the options, reviewing the pros and cons of what the choices are, none of that changes. But it does make it quite tough.
So, especially with like misinformation and social media nowadays, vaping is often seen as like a safe alternative to smoking, especially within teens and people our age in high school and stuff. From your perspective as a thoracic surgeon, what are the short and long-term risks you've seen in the lungs of young patients and even older patients from smoking and vaping?
Right. So I'm glad you brought that up. It is something that we did see this kind of trend develop in the recent past, given how popular these electronic devices have become. And yeah, there was a period where I think a lot of people were sort of misguided by the fact that this was somehow a safe way to consume tobacco products. Some of the data that I've seen indicates that it is perhaps safer than smoking tobacco or cigarettes or direct tobacco leaf itself, but it's certainly not good to be putting any kind of foreign objects, foreign substance into your lungs in that fashion. What I've seen, I think the effects of this generally are sort of long term, similar to the way cigarette smoking is or tobacco smoking is. But what I have seen and are that there's a period of time where there were some of these devices that are, I don't know where they're being made, but and what the quality control is, but some of these devices were being associated with rapid lung damage. And I have seen several patients, this is now several years ago, but several patients who presented with some serious lung damage of unclear reason why, and we ended up having to do a lung biopsy to figure that out. And it turns out that these things were linked to those products. So those are more extreme examples. I think that for the most part, people who are selling these are selling products that are being evaluated in some sense from quality, but it's still not healthy to put things into the lungs. And there still certainly is a cancer risk, among other risks, in terms of damaging your long-term pulmonary health.
Yeah, vaping is very dangerous, and people should not be doing that, and especially at such a young age where your lungs are still like normal and before you get older. And so, for people our age who never thought about it, what does lung cancer actually do to the lungs, and how does it affect someone's ability to breathe, move, or live normally?
Well, the most immediate thing is that it makes a spot within your normal lung tissue that's not normal, and that lung tissue doesn't function, meaning it doesn't help participate in gas exchange and things like that. So, but the reality of it is that quite a bit of your lung would have to be taken up by tumor until you were to really start to feel the effects of that. So most of our organs have quite a bit of functional reserve, right? So we can either have quite a bit of that organ removed or damaged or whatnot, and we may not be symptomatic from that for quite some time. So that is certainly one thing that can happen, that cancer can grow so big and it can impede your breathing. The bigger concern is that it spreads, right? With most cancers, that's the way that ends up being what, in those folks who don't end up beating the cancer, a lot of times that ends up being what the cause of death is, meaning it spreads outside of the primary site, it goes to other places, and it becomes much more difficult to control in that fashion. So I would say to young people who are thinking about, consuming tobacco products that, we put ourselves at risk for a situation that not only can be difficult to treat, but can be unpleasant to experience, right? If you're in the ICU, in and out of the hospital all the time, you're connected to an oxygen tank and have a hard time going from your bedroom to the bathroom. It can be a miserable way to live. And smoking is not the only way to get somebody to that point, but certainly it is a big contributor to that. I would think about things from the standpoint of, not only what the end result can be, but then the pathway to get into that end result might also be prolonged and not very pleasant. And so why put yourself at risk for that?
That brings up like the bigger question. People often talk about like it's like just like one disease, but is that really the case? Are there different types of lung cancer, like small cell lung cancer, or different care from like other types of cancer?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are several different types of lung cancer. There are a couple that are far and away the most common. The broad categories that you alluded to are there's small cell lung cancer and there's non-small cell lung cancer, and it just relates to the appearance of the cells under a microscope. So non-small cell lung cancer is far more common. Small cell lung cancer, thankfully, is far less common because it is also amongst the most aggressive types of lung cancer. Most of the time, we're not able to operate on a patient with small cell lung cancer because of the fact that it's very aggressive, spreads very quickly, and usually has spread by the time of diagnosis. All that being said, over the past few years, we are seeing more and more cases of early stage small cell lung cancer. And this again speaks to one of the benefits of lung cancer screening, right? Because people who are eligible for screening are going and getting their CT scans. We're finding little spots in the lungs when they're very small. We biopsy them, we take them out, and it turns out it's a small cell lung cancer. But traditionally, those are considered a non-surgical variety of lung cancer simply because it's advanced by the time we discover it. Non-small cell lung cancer is far and away the most common. The two most common types are adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. And again, those are just names that describe the type of cell that the cancer originated from. You can have an adenocarcinoma from another part of the body. You can have adenocarcinoma of the breast, of the colon, of the pancreas, et cetera. So it just speaks to the type of cell. Those two are the most common types of cancer. When we're talking about cancer treatment, the type of lung cancer doesn't often factor in as much when we're talking about what type of treatment. When we're talking about non-small cell lung cancer tumors, whether it's an adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, it doesn't factor as much into the type of treatment. It's more about the staging, right? So when somebody's diagnosed with a cancer, the very next thing we often do is do a bunch of tests to see what is the extent of that cancer as best as we can test based on the technology we have. Usually this involves different kinds of scans. Sometimes it involves biopsying things nearby the cancer to see if it has spread. Okay, so the stage of the cancer then generally dictates what your treatment strategy is going to be, right? If you do all your tests and this is looking like an early stage lung cancer, then usually you're offering surgery or in some cases radiation. Okay, and that's irrespective of the type of lung cancer it is, whether it's adenocarcinoma or squamous cell. On the other end of the spectrum, if you have somebody who at the time of diagnosis, there's already cancer spread to lots of places, that's a different set of treatments. And again, that would be the case whether this is an adenocarcinoma or a squamous cell carcinoma.
Obviously, you've mentioned screening a lot, but other than screening, are there any early warning signs or anything we can see beforehand to tell us kind of that we should go check in with our doctor, or just get a checkup?
You know, it's a great question. This is an area that is being studied and researched a lot. And it's mostly because of the fact that currently, when we're talking about who is eligible for lung cancer screening in the United States, meaning which patients are covered by insurance, it's a small fraction of patients within the US population. There is an age criteria and a smoking history criteria. So what that means is that there are patients that a lot of us in the lung cancer care community believe are at higher than average risk of making a lung cancer, but they don't meet the criteria to get a screening CT scan, so they can't get an annual CT scan. So this alludes to the question you're asking: what are those other patients that we should be screening? Because the answer to your question is there aren't really a lot of symptoms that we can pay attention to that might clue us in on, could this be a small lung cancer growing in my chest? When we develop symptoms, pulmonary symptoms, a lot of times, things are a little bit more advanced. It doesn't mean that it has spread to the point where it's not curable, but it certainly often means that it's more advanced. So it's not so much, I think, currently at least, I don't think it's as much about trying to educate patients. What are the signs we should look out for? And if you have these signs, run in and see your doctor to evaluate for lung cancer. That strategy probably will lead us to find a lot more advanced lung cancers. Instead, I think a lot of effort is focused on, for one, expanding the knowledge and awareness and agreement to undergo lung cancer screening if you're one of the people that already qualify. But also a big effort is being focused on looking at some of these other populations of people who probably should be getting screened for lung cancer. For instance, folks who have a family history of lung cancer. You've got several blood relatives, aunts and uncles, or even parents who have had lung cancer. Should they get screened, even if they've never smoked before? Probably. Certain known genetic syndromes that are associated with the high risk of lung cancer. What if you were a firefighter and you're out and battling, the fires in out in Napa Valley? Should you get lung cancer screening? Right. So there's a lot of different areas where we probably have the opportunity to screen more patients safely, and that's where a lot of research is being focused on now.
Yeah, I completely agree. Early signs and detecting before it actually happens is really important in saving so many people's lives. And I know that one area you specialize in is mediastinal tumors, like tumors that form in the space between the lungs, near the heart, and major blood vessels. It sounds really complex and risky area to operate. What exactly are these tumors? How do you safely treat something located in such a sensitive part of the body? And what are some symptoms a patient might experience if they have one?
That's great. That's a great question. Yeah, so this is shifting gears a little bit. So the mediastinum that you're talking about is essentially just another region of the chest, right? We sometimes sort of think about the chest as just one big cavity, which it is, but there are actually different compartments within that chest cavity. And when I say compartments, I mean tissue planes that separate, for example, the lungs from the heart. Right. So the two organs are not just touching each other. There's a sac that surrounds a lung. There's a sac that surrounds a heart, and they're actually in different compartments. So the mediastinum is simply another compartment in the chest. The anterior mediastinum, meaning the front of the mediastinum, is the region of the chest that's essentially between the heart and the breastbone. Right. So if we think about our heart in the center, we have our breastbone sort of out on the edge. There is actually a little bit of space in that area. I'm exaggerating it here, but that's what we call the anterior mediastinum. And in that location, yeah, we can grow tumors there, just like we can grow tumors in lots of other places in the body. The unique part aspect of the anterior mediastinum is that there, generally speaking, are only a handful of common tumors that will grow there. In medical school, you talk about the four T's, but that doesn't always apply. But the point is that there's not a lot of different things that end up growing in that space. And so, when you're meeting a patient and doing tests to figure out what it is, oftentimes you're focusing on, these handful of different things that can grow there. One of the things that can grow there that we do operate on are tumors of the thymus gland. Okay, so the thymus gland is an organ that sits right in front of the heart and behind the breastbone. Its job is it's responsible for helping to develop our immune system, and as we get into adulthood, it doesn't really function either at all or so much anymore. And but nonetheless, even if this is non-functional tissue, it can still make tumors and spots and things like that.
And just a quick question, are these all cancerous or can some be benign? And how does it really change your approach to treatment?
Yeah, it's a great question. So tumors of the thymus gland are generally not considered. We don't categorize tumors of the thymus gland into benign tumors or malignant tumors anymore. Okay, we used to do that. So there's the most common type of tumor from the thymus gland is called a thymoma. Okay, and we used to categorize them into benign thymomas and malignant thymomas. We don't do that categorization anymore because we understand any thymoma to have malignant potential. But it is true that many thymomas actually behave in a very indolent fashion, meaning they don't grow very quickly, don't spread very often, and so a lot of them are curable if we just take them out. So, when we're dealing with a spot or a mass in the anterior mediastinum, the approach can be quite nuanced, meaning that one has to generate a level of suspicion as to what they think it is, because the evaluation and the workup and the strategy, depending on what you think it is, may be different if you think it's this versus if you think it's that. And to be more specific, two common things that we deal with in adult patients at least are either lymphoma, which is a cancer of the lymphoid tissue of the lymph nodes, and thymomas, which again is a tumor of the thymus gland. They can both show up in this location and they can have similar features. So that's a decision that oftentimes thoracic surgeons are looking at. Does this have features more like a lymphoma, therefore should we test it in this fashion, or does this have features more like a thymoma, and therefore should we just go straight to surgery and take it out? So it gets pretty nuanced. You asked a question about surgery in this area. Yeah, it can be tricky because, like you said, lots of big blood vessels run in this area. It is sitting in front of the heart. There are some important nerves that also run in the area that control our diaphragm muscle, our breathing function. So it can be tricky in that area. But despite all that, we oftentimes can do minimally invasive surgery in that same area if we're dealing with a tumor that doesn't look particularly invasive or does isn't really, really large.
Kind of like moving and shifting gears to more patient care and innovation-based questions. Obviously, cardiothoracic surgery is very intense, and operating near the heart and lungs and just major organs can be seems very, very scary. Have there been any moments in the OR that really stuck with you throughout your career?
There have, and with any surgeon in any specialty, I'm sure they're that they will have those moments. I think one of the things about being a surgeon that's kind of drilled into you during training is to learn how to expect the unexpected or be prepared for the unexpected, and a big part of that is related to intraoperative events. And like you alluded to, if we're talking about surgery of the lungs and the heart, we're in and around these big structures that carry a lot of blood. A seemingly small injury, or perhaps a less significant injury in another part of the body, can be something very serious and life-threatening. If we're talking about, the heart or the lungs or the big blood vessels that run to and from the lungs. I have had, thankfully, not many, but I have had my fair share of those moments. And they do stick with you. Fortunately, knock on wood, they have turned out okay in all of those cases, meaning that able to get the bleeding stopped and get the patient out of the operating room. But they stick with you in a lot of ways. They stick with you first and foremost by really keeping you humble. As you get more and more through your training and into the start of your career, and you get more cases under your belt, particularly challenging cases, and they go well, you gain some confidence, as you should, and willing to see patients that may have trickier and trickier problems, and which is good. These are all good things, but it's also essential to continue to understand that there are always limitations to your skills and your knowledge, and therefore you should always be on the lookout for how to improve your skills, how to enhance your skills, and don't ever be misguided in thinking that bad things can't happen to you, because they can and they will. And so, in one way that these moments stick with you is it serves as a reminder for that. It also, when you get through a patient through that situation, it also does build some confidence. The nature of what we do here is that inevitably, as a thoracic and surgical oncologist, you're going to run into those situations. If you're doing these kind of complex tumors and really trying to give patients a chance and do something big, these will be situations you run into. So, having had those experiences and learning how to get out of them, in the long run will make you a better surgeon.
Yeah, all the training prepared. Sometimes problems might appear that it might be kind of tricky, but I feel like it does really help you become into a better doctor. And so, do you have any patient experience or stories that really stuck with you based on the surgery or maybe the patient experience afterwards?
I do. While trying to maintain patient privacy and things like that, I can think of certainly one that has really stuck with me. It was a patient who was middle-aged, and had ruptured his, so nothing to do with cancer. He had ruptured his esophagus. So in medicine, a ruptured esophagus is considered amongst the category of very serious problems, right? Folks can, get super sick. Their whole body can go into this big inflammatory state. In the old days, I mean, this was fatal in a very high percentage of patients. This is now less commonly where it's, well, people can still die from this problem, but we've gotten a lot better at saving people from this problem. At any rate, it was a case of that. The situation was that this gentleman was at another hospital, managed elsewhere for I think 2 or 3 weeks, not knowing this was the diagnosis, and eventually got transferred to my hospital, where we sort of had to kind of pick things up from there and quickly learned that he had a much bigger problem than what the other hospital was managing, and needed emergency surgery. And when folks have been in that condition for that long, the body can just be so tremendously stressed. And so the point is that he was just very ill. And what was memorable about that was just what measures were needed to get him through surgery, out of the operating room, and eventually a full recovery. This was a gentleman who had to go on the heart lung machine for a little while because his physiologic condition was so bad. His heart wasn't able to sustain the circulation. His lungs were not able to sustain his oxygen level. So he went on the heart lung machine for a little while and got transferred to our main campus in Palo Alto. And I guess the most memorable part of that was just the fact that, well, the way that he came under our care was kind of memorable because of the way that it was pitched as this is the problem, and when he showed up, it was actually a different problem. But also the fact that, when somebody is that tremendously ill, getting them to the recovered to the point where they can, walk into your clinic one day and shake your hand, I mean, that can be pretty challenging. And so that was a very memorable moment when he did eventually, several months later, walk into my clinic on his own 2 feet and shake my hand and tell me what he had for breakfast that day. That was a big, it was a very satisfying feeling for the whole team.
Yeah, I can only imagine seeing someone who you personally operated on come back healthy and talking to you. And obviously, like operating on patients is a very, very difficult part of your job. But in my mind, another part of your job that seems extremely hard is delivering like terrible news to patients, especially for cancer, as shown in so many televised shows. Like that moment seems like the whole world stopped. So how do you approach this, and what do you do for these kinds of experiences and situations?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, it's one of the hardest things we do as patient care providers is to give bad news. And telling somebody they have cancer certainly falls in line with that. So, my strategy is, for one, I don't think it ever helps to sugarcoat or beat around the bush for anything. So I'm very direct about it. Sometimes we know it's a cancer because I sent them for a biopsy and they've gotten the biopsy and it shows it's cancer. So I'm just very direct about it. Other times, the patient will come in to see us and they have a very concerning scan, but we don't have a biopsy, and I'll be very direct with them as well. I'll say, look, it could be X, Y, and Z, but I think most likely we're going to be dealing with and treating a lung cancer, so let's get ready for that. So I think being direct helps. The very next thing I do after I deliver that bad news is try to explain all the different ways why there's plenty of hope and optimism here. So, for example, if I'm delivering the news that this biopsy is a lung cancer, if this looks like an early stage lung cancer, the very next thing I say to them is, you know, early stage lung cancer is actually very curable. We don't talk about that enough in the news or on the media, but you know, early stage, more patients with early stage lung cancer are cured than those who are not. And so I try to put that out there front and center so they have something to think about when they leave my office. I think letting them explaining what the game plan is and just being really clear and concise about what our strategy is going to be, even laying out a timeline for them can be helpful. You know, we'll get a biopsy done, that'll take a week, and then after that, we'll get a PET scan, that'll take another week. We may be ready for, if everything checks out, we may be ready for surgery in 3 or 4 weeks. I think that does a lot to help to take away some of the unknowns about something so scary such as lung cancer. There are other situations where you're delivering bad news, and you know it's a little bit worse than saying this is an early stage lung cancer. For instance, you may be the first person to tell a patient, you know, I'm sorry, this is metastatic, uncurable lung cancer, and that's, you know, very difficult to hear. But in the same fashion, you know, I try to then very quickly explain that although stage four cancer of any variety is not generally considered curable, most stage four cancers are actually very treatable. Meaning, we got lots of treatments and tools and options and drugs that can be given to reduce the size of the cancer, reduce the burden of the cancer, slow the growth, slow the spread, eliminate or reduce symptoms, which are all forms of treatment. Okay, but just, you know, whether or not it can be cured, you know, that sometimes we have to tell patients, unfortunately not. Last thing I'll say on this is that I think a big part of being a doctor or a patient care provider is not only treating the actual medical problem, but also treating everything that goes along with it. You know, the emotional distress, the feeling of doom, the need for, you know, support, whether it's social support, you know, getting family together. So I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, even though sometimes all you can do is give the bad news, and medically speaking, you might not be able to offer any treatment. I think the information you share and the explanations you give can go a long way.
So, what advice would you give to students or young people who are thinking about going this field or your specialty?
Absolutely. It's a great question, important question. The very first advice I would give is that you got to make sure you like it. You got to make sure you got a passion for it. Something about the medical sciences or the medical field has to excite you. And I think that's the case more or less for any profession that really becomes a meaningful career. But certainly for medicine, I think it's just oh so critical. You know, I think it's no mystery that certain professions are very challenging. It's a very challenging pathway to get through. And medicine is, I think, amongst the most challenging simply because it's so rigorous to get into a school and then get into a specialty you want and whatnot. It's always a very difficult situation where when somebody who is somewhat far along that pathway finally comes to the realization that just medical science is just not for them, clinical care is just not for them. And I have personal friends who have made that decision either during medical school or during training. And yeah, it's challenging. It can do a lot, you know, to your mental health when you discover that that's the reality of things. Because you know, a lot of times these are folks who spent a good part of their schooling in their early adulthood, you know, focusing on this. So I would say as best you can, really think about what it is about medicine that you enjoy. What is it that you see yourself wanting to do with a job or a career? And if medicine suits those desires and those interests, I would absolutely say go for it. From a practical standpoint, you know, unfortunately in the here and now, you know, things like grades and test scores do play a role. And, you know, one of the reasons why I think it's going to be challenging to ever see that go away completely is that when you're talking about tens of thousands of applicants to a medical school, right? How to whittle that down to a reasonable number of people that you can actually bring in to interview, it becomes very challenging to be able to, in a practical way, you know, go from 25,000 applicants to, you know, 600 or 800 interviews, right? And so there needs to be a somewhat systematic way. And at least, again, for the here and now, Part of that are grades and test scores. So that is not a so it's not an end all be all. If you had a bad day and you had a bad test score, or you had a bad, semester and you had a bad grade, far from that. Okay. Many people, most people I know who are in medical school or sorry, who I met in medical school or now my colleagues and our doctors, have had something of that variety. So it's far from insurmountable, but the point is that that should be a priority. Okay, that should be the way you approach your academics, understanding that not only this, set you up to with the good foundational knowledge, but just the reality of it is, that when you're looking at that volume of applications, you have to have some way to benchmark that. So I would say that, you really want to make sure that you're putting enough time on those things. But at the same time, if you're an individual who only has great test scores and great grades, but you don't have a lot of other things that demonstrate your interest in being a clinician or a physician, that individual also will likely have a hard time getting into a medical school. Okay, so it sort of goes back to what I said in the beginning, is that it's got to be something that you like, and it's got to be something that you feel like you have genuine interest for, and those folks end up being most successful.
And to end out our episode today, if you had a chance to speak directly to every high school student about their lungs, what would you say?
I would say that your lungs are one of your most important organs in your body. If we think about it, our lungs are in constant contact with the environment every minute, multiple times a minute, right? What I'm referring to is when we take a breath, right? When we take a breath, stuff from the outside goes into the inside, and then we exhale and it goes back in the outside. And that happens 10, 15 times every minute, every single waking moment of your life, right? So a lot of things go into our lungs. Okay. So we don't want to put anything more into our lungs that doesn't belong there. Okay. There's enough pollutants and bad things that you'll get just walking around being a human being on planet Earth. We don't have to put tobacco smoke or cigarette smoke or whatnot in there to further complicate things. That'd be my best message.
Well, Dr. Liu, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. From complex surgeries to life-saving moments, we've learned that our lungs and everything in our chest deserve way more attention than we give them. And whether it's speaking up about a symptom, quitting that vape or smoking, or just understanding what's going on inside your body, awareness can truly save lives. So again, thank you so much for joining, and we will see you guys next time on White Coats Real Talk.
Thank you so
Thanks to
much.
both of you again. Congratulations on this wonderful project.
Thank you.